Hi, and welcome to the Entrepreneur Organization Business Podcast. I am your host, Lynn Padetti. Now, my guest today is Eamon Eastwood, an Irish-born entrepreneur and the visionary founder and CEO of Taste. Now, through his omni-channel distribution company, Taste Food Distributors, Eamon brings iconic European brands to life and is a driving force in the world of flavors, making the world feel smaller through the irresistible tastes of home. In this episode, Eamon shares the challenges he faced when starting his e-commerce and distribution business. He discusses how he navigated macro factors such as foreign exchange and increases in shipping costs, as well as dealing with large supermarket chains like Coles and Woolworths. You will learn about the challenges involved and what it takes to really grow a product business successfully. Now, please join me in welcoming Eamon. Welcome to the show, Eamon. How are you today?
Yes, I'm very good, Lynn. It's absolutely a pleasure to be here. I know you've got your nice cup of tea there.
Thank you so much. So this is Barry's tea from Ireland.
Yes.
And this is Eamon's product here. I've got the tea right here to try. And this is going to be one of the memorable experiences on doing a podcast.
Yeah, we're huge tea drinkers in Ireland. You know, it doesn't matter what the occasion, whether it's a crisis or we're celebrating something. You go to somebody's house to say, do you want a cup of tea? And it's just a beautiful way to say, do you want a chat? Sit down and give me the crack and tell me what's going on in your life. And that's what you use cup of tea, the tea for, you know.
Well, perfect timing, because my goal is to have one coffee a day and the rest is tea or something else healthy. So, but before we get distracted talking about other things, we're here to really learn more about your journey and kind of understand some of the challenges you've had in business. So take us through, you know, how did you, I know you've got an Irish accent, you're from Ireland and you're now here in Sydney. So tell us a little bit about your backstory.
Yeah, well, look, I was born in Northern Ireland, in the north part of Ireland, 1976. And I left there when I was 18 to go to university in Glasgow. I lived in the States for a while and then I came to Australia. But, you know, growing up in Northern Ireland at that time was quite unique. There was a war going on, you know, between, I guess, the IRA and the British state forces. So to me, growing up in that time, I felt it was normal because I didn't know any different. But on reflection, it was abnormal, and there was daily violence and bombings and shootings. And it really, on reflection, you know, I've been an expat for over 25 years now. You reflect on your childhood and the environment you grew up in and how it shaped you. And I think I'm no different. That growing up in that sort of environment, your community becomes really, really tight. And community is really, really important. And it was more because it was about our identity. The pride of that. So that really shaped a lot of my decisions, I guess. And even to start this very niche, unique business on the other side of the world about bringing Irish products over to the expat community and then trying to scale that was really about that's a community and being, you know, bringing pride to where I'm from and making those people proud of that, you know, and being part of a vibrant Irish community, because the community that I came from and grew up in was, I guess it was broken because of the segregation and the sectarian divides where I came from. So that's really shaped my decisions in business, the early decisions in business. And it gave me a lot of passion and fuel to get it started. But I don't know if it was enough to sustain it. I really had to be more business focused and, you know, was there demand for these products and could we get them into the big channels, the big supermarkets and stuff. So that I think was really the seed that dropped for me. Now, my surname is Eastwood as well. And funny enough, it's not an Irish name, but it's synonymous in the small town that I came from in Ireland. They were all in business. They were a very entrepreneurial family. More particularly tradesmen or agriculture, which tends to be quite a big dominant trades in that part of Ireland. And so we were very entrepreneurial from day one, and my uncles and aunts and grandfather, all the shops all around the street, the town where I'm from, and Eastwood was up there, and I used to work in those shops. We had a clothes shop, and so maybe that's where I got my love for fashion as well. And so that's that planted the seed too, that I think it was in my DNA as well. So when I came down here, there was no Irish food products when I came here as a 24-year-old for the Olympic Games. And I wanted to work at the Olympic Games, which I did. And then I wanted to stay here. And I started this business a few years after that. And we've grown it ever since.
Okay. So tell me more about your business. So Taste Island, I know it has kind of different divisions. So yeah, share a little bit of that as well.
Yeah, so quite recently in 2018, I changed the structure of the business where the B2B part of the business was Taste Food Distributors. And then Taste Ireland, which was the original name, became the online store specifically. And all our social media channels spoke to that customer, the end user. And then last year, we started the British Corner Store as well, which is replicating our success with the Taste Ireland store. And we definitely could do that with other nationalities in some way. So at the essence of the business is, you know, making the world smaller through the taste of home. Is that taste of home, that emotional attachment that people have with the brands that they're familiar with where they grew up as kids. And that's part of it, really is. And that's the essence of what we do is that belonging to home and that connection to home, whether if someone's sending a hamper from one part of the world to the other. So that was a powerful part with online, but it's always been B2B and D2C from day one. Lynn, where... And even back as when we first started in 2005, I had an online store, and it wasn't long after the .com bubble that Facebook hadn't even started. Mm-hmm. So it was probably unpopular to have an online store in those days, but it certainly was a huge learning curve, and it was great to test products online and then elevate them into the wholesale part of the business. So that's what we do. You use the online store, much greater variety online. Smaller volumes, we can test and measure stuff there. There's gifting. And then the really popular products and products that we're in relationship with the brands back in that part of the world, we can then bring them as a partnership to Woolworths, Coles, and the independents. So the biggest curve in terms of growth in the business was when Woolworths and Coles came on board for us in 2010 and 2013, William Coles came on board because we were investing more and more into the international section category in Australia because of multicultural society. And we were really well positioned to at least tackle the Irish part and then add products there where other nationalities.
Mm. So in the earlier days, how did you kind of test out the products? Like, are you familiar with these products already? And so you brought in, you know, how much volume, like how do you actually test out new products when you're thinking about, launching a product?
No, it's a great question. As we've scaled and grown, it's even more vital to not be bringing over products that are just not going to move, you know. And I guess we are very data-centric. We do have really close relationships with all the food bodies back in the UK and Ireland, and obviously brand manufacturers. In this space, the word nostalgia tends to pop up quite a lot, where there's recognized brands that have huge traction, and not just in the domestic market, but, you know, and they've obviously exported as well. Some of these brands, you know, like McFitties or Jacobs or Rangtree's, really well-established brands. So that gives the buyer, let's say the Woolworths or Coles buyer, a bit of confidence that, you know, these brands have been operating for 25 years. We've got scanned data, proof of the sales in the domestic market. And that really gives them the confidence to try them on their shelves in Woolworths and Coles. Because in the international section, it's limited space and they just want the best of the best. You know, it's just like a highlight reel of the most nostalgic, popular products. And saying that, look, we listen to the customer. The customer gives us feedback on what products they would like to see down here. There's an absolute move, as you can see in the market, a move towards better for you products, healthier products. A lot of, you know, a number of our products are confectionery and snacking and those sort of like naughty products, if you like. They're good for the soul, but maybe not good for the body all the time. But so we are conscious of that, and we're moving into trending categories as well, and to stay relevant. You know, we're working with a really exciting keto brand at the minute that is doing really good stock in the UK. So we're excited about that type of thing to bring this new emerging brands.
Yeah. That sounds like a great idea because I'm kind of a health fanatic and I try not to eat too much chocolate. But I think So really, I'll be that customer of yours. You know, and how did you get into Woolworths and Coles? Like, what are some of the challenges in dealing with big guys like that? Because I think maybe as an entrepreneur, you're excited that there are these big brands, big, you know, distributors that can take on your brand. But I'm sure it comes with some kind of challenges as well, right?
I never really thought we'd get into Woolworths and Coles, and maybe that was my naivety and experience with dealing with the large retailers back when we first started. And I also was very aware of the challenges of importing products from one side of the world to the other. I mean, it's a global supply chain business, really. And, you know, with our perishable products, you know, some of the, like, maybe 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. It's just not, it's obviously not cheese or butter or bread. It's not that perishable, but nonetheless, they've all got a production life and a best before date. So that whole world changed completely in 2010 when Woolworths contacted us, funny enough. And they'd seen our, they'd obviously seen some of our products in the market, you know, in the independent retailers and online store, and then they were doing their due diligence and they were trying to build out these international bays, and certainly there was a huge population of Irish expats that lived here, not just presently, but, you know, like we had first settlers with the British that came here. So there was a real legacy of Irish settlement here. And so, you know, having an Irish presence in their supermarkets was quite important. So I guess they contacted us. They says, look, come on in. Let's see what you have. We like some of your products. I went in with my little cheap suit on me and went in there stack and brought in samples. And we were fortunate enough to get 4 new products listed in 600 stores. And, you know, 2 years later, Coles replicated that success, and the two supermarkets tend to keep an eye on each other and see what they're doing, and that's how it's sort of grown ever since. You've introduced more brands, developed that relationship, and but we need to be, it needs to be two ways, because we need to make sure that the supplier is really on board as well, that they understand the quirks of this export market in terms of packaging, labeling, ingredients, commercials, and promotional support, marketing support. So there really has to be, some of our relationships are transactional, but some of them are actually brand partnerships where, you know, we're going into battle together, and where it's a brand development exercise from day one. And we've got this opportunity to get into, you know, 2,000 stores maybe with Woolworths and Coles. So we want to make it work. There's certain demands that are placed on brands to make it work, whether it's promotional or above the line marketing or whatever it takes to move that product off the shelf.
Mm. So, you know, with Coles and Woolworths, I hear that, you know, it's like, it's almost like an estate within their shopping, their shops, where, you know, there are upper shelves, bottom shelves, and kind of far away. You know, how do you get to be on the top shelf versus the bottom shelf? How do you make sure that you have enough stock for them to stock as well? Yeah. So what are some of the challenges that people could kind of consider when it comes to working with big?
It's funny, I studied consumer psychology at university, and I'm fascinated by that subject. And if you think about the layout of supermarkets, and you know, the old adage in retail is eye level is buy level. So if it's at your eye level, you're typically going to buy that first, and they tend to be the bigger margin products in the supermarkets. And if you notice where bread and milk is located in the supermarket, which is that daily essential, you know where it's located?
Far away, because you know you can get it.
Supermarket, so you have to walk through the whole supermarket to get it. And hopefully you'll pick up a few other little items on your way out anyway, and that's the intention. So the whole psychology of the layout of it, and the products at the bottom, maybe the home brand, or tend to be maybe slower moving products. But I guess in the bigger categories, I would imagine that there would be some funding going towards getting in a prime position. You know, there would be a lot of that jockeying for positioning. And even within our category, which is more of a destination shopping category, where it's the international space, you know, it's very quickly, you can see that the impulse brands, the confectionery, the snacking, moves really quickly. And that's the most key thing in supermarkets, Lynn, in terms of metrics, in terms of measurables, is how many units per week per store is that product selling? And that this is a metric across every product in these supermarkets, is that they'll, that there's certain hurdles to hit. And if you're not hitting those hurdles, then there's a good chance it'll be delisted and you need a product that's going to move quicker. So they'll have expectations within a category of subcategories of how those products are going to perform. And if they're not performing, then they're going to get delisted. So it's all real estate at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
Else is real estate, and they need to be paying the rent to those products. So that's the way they view it. That's pressure.
Yeah. And I mean, with dealing with them, do they also usually have like a long payment terms as well? So it can be quite, I guess, risky for distributors.
Yeah, also. Absolutely. Yeah, you got to measure manage your financial component in terms of risk and when you're getting paid. So there's negotiations with your suppliers to get terms. And in terms, it takes 60 days to get the product from Europe to here on average. So, you know, let's say your supplier gave you 30 days. That's not good enough because the products aren't even halfway to Australia and they weren't paid. And so it's so vital that you have negotiated, you know, payment terms that give you a bit of breathing space to then, once it arrives in Australia, then you start the sales cycle. And then equally, your bigger retailers might have certain terms as well. So you want to negotiate favorably there that you're getting paid on time, because you could end up in a scenario where you're bankrolling the supplier and the retailer for 6 months. Mm-hmm. So that's not sustainable. And it's just, it was pretty much like that, you know, in the early days, where we had to do inventory financing just to get going, which is certainly eating into the margin of what is relatively thin margins in this game, right? We had to fight our corner in terms of the supplier saying, look, we're building this volume, we're building this brand, your brand in this market. We need more elasticity in the current payment terms. And then we have to play hardball with the big suppliers as well and say, look, we really want to service you. You got pays on time to give us that that end. So this is the management, you know. So of the two sides of the coin.
Yeah. Do you have to have people on the ground in Ireland to kind of negotiate with suppliers and things, or you can do it all remotely?
Yeah, it's all remotely. I mean, I've used business, you know, some food consultants recently, actually in the UK, but by and large, it's. I used to go home, like post-COVID, I'd fly home every year, just did different food shows in Europe and the UK and Ireland, and just the regular check-ins with the suppliers, you know, virtually. So we were doing the virtual thing well before COVID kicked in, you know, and that keeps the whole communication alive and see what's relevant in the market. So most of it is done virtually.
Gotcha. And yeah, in terms of importing challenges, you know, what's been happening since, you know, COVID or even after COVID time?
Yeah, look, recently, and it's been quite the challenge. COVID, funny enough, had its challenges where we lost a number of independent retailers like bars and cafes, but they keep coming, right? But then the online took over, and, you know, it was growing 60% year on year during COVID. And now it's sort of stabilized at that height, which is really encouraging, and then starting to sort of grow a little bit more too. So it's really boosted the online side of the business. So we're really grateful that we had that diversity within our business model. So I was quite optimistic. But then the second year of COVID, supply issues really started to mount up, where, you know, domestic supply in Europe was getting priority over export. And there was a real skeleton staff crew in these factories that were doing the pickpacking and the distributing, the dispatch and stuff. So there was huge delays of goods coming out. So that's why there's such empty shelves and wings and bowls, because it was happening across the board. So that was really hurting us. And then when that started to stabilize, the shipping prices went up like 3-4 times out of Europe, the cost of shipping. So, you know, we had to react really quick in terms of cost price increases to try and not absorb too much of that price increases. So that's been challenging. And now we're faced with, you know, cost of living prices, and people being careful about what they're buying, interest rates, and now So yeah, look, most businesses are facing similar challenges, I guess. It's just about what factors you try and put in place. So for example, the foreign exchange is a big factor in our business. Now, you know, we're paying in euro and US for shipping and sterling for UK products. And so we hedge. We have to hedge 3 and 6 months in advance to protect our margin, which is another factor to play. So there's a number of macro factors when you're importing products from one side of the world to the other that you need to protect your margin, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've been in this industry for so long. I think 2005, did you say? Have you seen, more competitors coming in or, challenges in that way other than the macro factors?
Probably not, not really. And I would put that down to the complexity. And, it's not that simple. And it seems simple. No, we'll just bring this product from that part of the world over here and we'll sell it. And simple in theory. But, the complexity of the supply chain and the relationship with the suppliers and the compliance around bringing products into this country, into Australia, all add to that complexity. So you do get a few what's called grey R&L importers who will maybe slip under the radar and bring in a couple of pallets of this or that and have a go. You're going to get that now and again. It's a very hard thing to police, but that can sort of hurt you for a small period of time, and that's happened over the years, but they do fade away, and you just have to certainly be robust enough to fight off those challenges. And for Wheeler and Cole's competitors in there, there's a number of other international distributors who play in that space. And then in general, we're just fighting for space on shelf, I guess, you can bring the best innovation, the best products that are going to move off the shelf and excite the customer. But overall, there's just that natural competition you get from the other suppliers, the Wheaties and Coles, but from an independent retail space, we're quite unique.
That's amazing. So just curious, you've been in the business for so long as well, like what keeps you motivated? What keeps you driven as a CEO? And, I can hear there's so much challenges when it comes to running an e-commerce business or importing. So your mindsets and what do you think about to help you really push through all these challenges?
Yeah, we've grown up in school. I wasn't particularly academically gifted, and it was all I wanted to do was play football for Manchester United. And I did get close. I played semi-professional soccer and played at the Manchester United Soccer School of Excellence as a kid. I was 11 years of age. So that really was my dream, was to play soccer. And so school was secondary to me. But the thing that really spiked my interest in my early 20s was kidpreneurship, is entrepreneurship for kids. And I just thought that was such a cool idea for schools to teach that type of thing, because there's this academic side of school education, really into the books, and you're going to be a doctor and you're going to be a lawyer and you're going to be, and then there's not all kids are like that. It's about spotting the genius within the kid, as opposed to everybody needs to be pushed down that alleyway. And if you don't go down that alleyway, then you're stupid. And this was the teaching. So there was this huge section of kids, including myself, who thought we were stupid because we weren't going down this traditional route of academic education. And also, to me, it was a memory game. It was remembering stuff and doing it at the end. And I really questioned that, because when are you ever tested like that outside of school? So it was crazy. And I thought it was a prehistoric for the Industrial Revolution, basically. And it didn't suit the model that was happening in the market today. And that's why I was really passionate about kids' entrepreneurship. And as I shared earlier, I wrote a book there a few years ago on this subject. It's a small little kid's book. It's on Amazon. And so that really fuels me in terms of, I think, the sweet spot for me was, yes, it was big into sport, but if there was a bit more of a tactile approach to learning, be it entrepreneurship, for example, I think I personally would have responded quite well to that in school. So I did get involved in that at an early age here, and I designed the first Club Kidpreneur after schools program with an entrepreneur called Craig Price. And that sort of fueled my passion So the bottom line is that I haven't really worked for anyone else. You know, maybe I'm unemployable.
Yeah.
And so I'm maybe reluctant to look beyond being in business. And that said, I do have aspirations to, you know, probably exit this particular business in the future and maybe move into a bit more food and tech side of things. And, you know, think Uber, think Amazon, think just the movement of food through technology. I think that really, even drones, for example, so that word excites me. The e-commerce word excites me, you know. So yes, there's challenges in the logistics and the uncertainty around that and managing the risk in that. And I guess the other side of the business, that digital side, is really fueling my appetite. But in general, it's that whole, I think me as a learner, the type of learner that I probably wasn't at, was that more tactile entrepreneurship than I think when I would have resonated with in schooling. So,
Love it. So looking back when you were starting out, like what would you tell yourself if you got a chance to talk to that, you know, old Eamon back then? What tips would you say to them, to him?
Yeah, there was a lot of learning on the way then, you know, there was a lot of failure and learning on the way. And I guess if someone analyzed my business back in those early days, they told me to stop, you know, like just because it was such a niche and no one else was doing it, I sort of had time to tinker away at trying to make it work. If it was a highly competitive industry, I probably would have been squashed, you know. And so that was such a learning. So I did persist, and there was a lot of tenacity to keep it, to make it successful. And maybe that was a fear of going to get a job, I don't know, that kept me going. So this, you certainly would have patted myself on the back and said keep it going, but at the same time maybe to keep the business simple as well, you know, to simplify the business and not over to make it over complex, and maybe bring in a 2IC stroke partner a bit earlier, perhaps, to carry some of that burden and to share some of the growth strategies, that it was really lonely in those early days and trying to work it all out myself. I didn't know anything about importing, exporting, customs, quarantine, Woolies and Coles negotiations, supplier negotiations. And so it was really on the tools learning for a long time, and I guess bringing in a mentor type C2IC would have really helped.
Yeah. Don't we wish we can just turn back time and fix a few things? But then again, you can't have learned, and we can't be sitting here sharing these learnings with others if we didn't do that.
Yeah, very true. I mean, I have to say that the foundational grinding level is probably what's sustaining me now, because it's rock solid. Like, I mean, I know it came from my bed. I imported 50 boxes of chips and stored them in my bedroom near Burwood, and I delivered them to Irish Pubs at night while I was working in construction during the day. So I know I've done the hard yards. Like, I've done the university degree, 100%, and I think that's what's holding me in really good stead now in these sort of a bit more challenging times, you know.
Lovely. So this leads me to the last question as we wrap up this show, is I usually like to ask you this deep question is, you know, what do you want the world to remember Eamon for ultimately?
Yeah, well, look, I came from a very small town in Ireland, and I left there when I was 18. But I've always felt very much, you know, part of home. And now that my parents are getting a bit older, it's harder. But ultimately, I think what the essence of what I've tried to do in my career to date and the future is to make the world smaller through the tastes of home, and to use food as a transformative power and to connect humanity. You know, I know that sounds quite grandiose, but it's in the essence, like, I mean, you know, for someone who's living in Australia, who might be forced to come down here, they may not have wanted to leave home, and wherever they've came from, whether it's Vietnam or Ireland or wherever, and that they can have some connection to home, whether it's brands from home or a recipe from home, and to share it at a family event. To me, that's everything. Like, I mean, to family connection And that essence of feeling of belonging and home when you're so far away from home is just beautiful. And so I think that's that in a nutshell is what I'm about. And I think that's what our brand represents.
Yeah, I love that. That really hit home with me. And if you guys haven't already tried the food from Taste Island, it is amazing. The chocolates and the lollies and the tea as well. Actually, there it is. But thank you so much for being so today, Eamon. I'll put all your details on the description below. But thank you again for your time.
No, thank you, Elena. It's great to chat.